morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Luright. Well, coming up today, we'll meet another candidate running for the Democratic nomination for Congressional District 15. It's likely to be one of the most hotly contested races in Florida this November. But first, two comments about yesterday's program, on which we heard from a Trump campaign surrogate, a former congresswoman from New York, who was critical of Joe Biden's support for a public option for health insurance, and she was an opponent of single-payer system, which now, according to recent polls, has the support of most Americans. Here's what two listeners had to say.
St. Pete, I did want to comment today on the lady that just seemed to be talking in circles about health insurance. Yeah, you brought up a really good point, Rob, where you brought up all the just psycho writing in your policy, and then she wouldn't address it, and then she started babbling on and cutting down Medicare, and she did not make one coherent statement. She would make a statement, and she'd be on a point, and she didn't really understand the point, and then she would change the point and go to some other subject. And all I know is this, in Germany, I have three friends that live over there, and I have a German family that lives across the street from me. You see no bills in Germany. But basically in Germany, you go to a dentist, you go to a doctor, you don't see a bill. They still have a full national health care system, just like Canada, Israel, Great Britain, France, Spain, Portugal, Switzerland, Finland, Norway, Denmark, it still goes on. So anyway, we're still in the same battle with no health care.
This is Howard in Georgia. I was listening to your show this morning with the ex-congressional rep from New York. She's a perfect example of disinformation spreaders. Now, regardless of what political party affiliations she has, her ignorance of health care plans in other countries is really no surprise. These politicians don't care about health care. They want higher revenues for all major industries who are in the medical industrial complex, as they make huge contributions to all parties. And she proudly announced up front that her husband's involvement with a huge medical conglomerate. So guess where her priorities lie? Medicare does work. She couldn't even finish a cohesive sentence about it. I have a terrific Medicare plan, and it costs less than half what I used to pay in an employee-sponsored plan, with more benefits. She wanted to blame consumer diversity. Well, that's systemic racism if I ever heard it. Which consumers are the least able to afford insurance in the open market? As far as consumer choice goes, the Supreme Court just limited that very nicely, and I'm sure they'll continue to do so.
Some listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. Well, there's a primary election on August 18th here in Florida, and among the contests, a three-way race among Democrats to win the right to face off against a Republican in November for that congressional seat. The seat is currently held by Ross Spano. He does face a challenger in the Republican primary. We're talking about the 15th Congressional District, which includes parts of Eastern Hillsborough, Polk, and Lake Counties. The cities of Plant City and Lakeland are within it. Our guest today is Alan Cohn, a veteran journalist who's worked for newspapers and several TV stations, including Channel 7, the ABC affiliate in Sarasota. I spoke with candidate Cohn yesterday. Alan Cohn, welcome to WMNF. Nice to have you here.
Good day. It's exciting to be with you and your audience, and we're working hard.
All right. So my first question is, why do you want the job? Why do you want to be a member of Congress?
Because I've always wanted to utilize the skills that I have developed over 30 years as an investigative reporter and apply that to what's going on in Washington right now. Lord knows, I think the times call for something different. If you watch what's going on there, people have become incredibly cynical about politics and politicians. If you look at any kind of congressional hearing, you see members giving more speeches than asking direct questions when so much serious, things are going on in the government right now. And for 30 years, you know, I have served this country in this state and in this community by, speaking truth to the most powerful corporations and people and uncovering that defense contractors were putting defective parts on military equipment and having the backs of consumers and then exposing public corruption. And I think that these skills are needed now more than ever in Congress, and I don't think we can wait.
Alan, you're a Democrat. President Trump won the district, Congressional District 15, by 10 points. What makes you think a Democrat can win that seat?
Well, there are a number of reasons, including that this congressional district has been steadily going towards the Democrats. And as we speak right now, there are only 3,000 more Republicans than Democrats. And also, you know, a third of registered voters are NPA or independents. And, you know, what my argument to folks is that, you know, I am a middle-class guy. My wife and I have raised two great children in this community, in the public schools, and we have ridden the ups and downs of an economy that does not work for middle-class and working families. And we don't have a congressman that ever speaks to these issues. It's rare that we have a candidate that speaks to these issues, and people are falling behind as, you know, wages are stagnant and the prices of everything, even before the pandemic, go up. So if I talk about these things and tell people that my prime focus of this campaign is to do my level best to work on solutions to these issues and make things better, then we're going to win this race.
Let's talk about healthcare for a moment. 3 million Floridians do not have health insurance. We do have the ACA, but for some people it's controversial. What would you do to improve access to healthcare in the U.S. where tens of millions of people are not covered by health insurance?
And if they are lucky to be covered by health insurance, they are drowning because of the huge deductibles, which really makes actually using it almost unaffordable. If a family, whether it's through the Affordable Care Act or if you're lucky enough to have, you know, insurance through your employer, many of these plans now carry $4,000 to $6,000 deductibles. And think about it. You have to spend $4,000 to $6,000 until the plan pays 80% of your claim. And, you know, most families live on such margins that if you have to spend $300 or $400 to go to the doctor or take your kid to the doctor, you know, most families can ill afford to take that out of their monthly budget. So, you know, our health system is not working. We need to reform the Affordable Care Act to mandate that states expand Medicaid coverage instead of leaving them up to decide. We need to create a public option, not for-profit government health care insurance that would compete in the private health insurance market. And the increased competition would bring down costs and increase access and improve the quality of care to all people. And, you know, this is also important. We need to prevent the health insurance industry from creating corporate super PACs so they can fund multi-million dollar ad buys in competitive House districts like this one and Senate races and in swing states in order to put political pressure on politicians to maintain the status quo. If you ever want to know why things don't get done, that's it.
Our guest is Alan Cohn. He's one of three Democrats running for the Congressional District 15 seat nomination. That district is currently held by a Republican. The district includes parts of Eastern Hillsborough County, Brandon, Plant City, parts of Polk County, including Lakeland and Bartow, and parts of Lake County. And this is WMNF in Tampa. Alan, what do you think of the Canadian system of single-payer health insurance?
You know, if it works for folks in Canada, that's great. And there are obviously advantages to it. But what I'm most concerned about is, you know, despite what I just said in terms of the need to improve the Affordable Care Act and the limitations of even employer-based health care, there are people in certain industries who do like their health care plans, including in labor. You know, our union brothers and sisters have for years fought hard for good health care plans. And I don't think you could say to them that they have to give up these plans and go to something that they don't know about and have questions about and have concerns about. So, you know, I think we need to fix the Affordable Care Act and add that public option. But I don't think that you could convince people who are happy with their health care to just give it up.
The federal minimum wage right now is $7.25 an hour. Florida's is slightly higher. The minimum wage, the national minimum wage, has continually lost buying power since 1968. What is a fair and right minimum wage? What minimum wage should Congress set for the country?
Well, you know, 6 years ago, in the dead of the night, early morning hours, I was on a bullhorn on JFK Boulevard in front of McDonald's, calling for a $15 minimum wage. And the reason why it's important is, and you know, to be quite frank, I listened to your interview with Adam Hattersley yesterday, and you asked him the same question. And when you asked him about the $15 minimum wage, he said that we have to get to that. But back in September, speaking to another audience with maybe a different demographic on Fox 13, he was asked the same question, and his answer to the $15 minimum wage was not necessarily. I mean, that's why people are cynical about politics and their politicians when they hear candidates for office change their message depending on who they're talking to. You know, the federal minimum wage hasn't increased in over a decade. It does not keep in pace with inflation. It basically traps individuals and families and communities in generational poverty. When we allow companies, like Walmart, to pay almost starvation raises, wages, it means that workers are forced to apply for welfare benefits in order to pay their rent and provide for their families. And what do we do know about when people are making more money? When they make more money, they spend more money. It is good for business. And, it will lift, it's not only good for business, it will lift all boats, and it will free people who are just trapped in this, cycle of poverty. And this has other implications. It has implications in terms of domestic violence and then mental health and drug addiction, because so many people are under so much pressure and so much stress because of their economic situation, because they don't make a livable wage. You know, $15 an hour would represent a significant increase in the minimum wage. But even you try living a family four on $15 an hour. It is very difficult to survive on that. So, $15 minimum wage is a starting point. As an economy and as a society, we have got to do better.
What do you think of the Black Lives Matter movement?
Well, you know what? I've gone to the rallies both in Lakeland and in Tampa. And, quite frankly, it's not enough to say Black lives do matter. You know, I was watching a stand-up performance just yesterday that my son was showing to me by, one of the hosts of Saturday Night Live. And he was saying, why is it controversial to say that Black lives matter? We're not saying Black lives are better. We're not saying they're more important. We're just saying it matters. That should not be, a controversial thing. And it's also really important to know. And again, I listened to your great interview yesterday with Mr. Hattersley, and he paraphrased a story about Jesus in terms of a missing sheep from a flock, and people asked Jesus why he went and cared for that sheep. And the response was because sometimes, animal or thing needs attention at that time. We're not talking about a moment in time here. I mean, that's crazy. We're talking about hundreds of years where African Americans have faced the kind of issues that we are only dealing with today. And it is time for well past time for all of us to step up and deal with institutionalized racism and reform our policing. And coming to the party late, begin the process of reforming how police relate to not only the African American community but to all communities, and making policing more reflective of the communities that they're serving. You know, I don't come late to this party. I have in the next room a front page story that I wrote for the Boston Globe years ago, uncovering a brutal police beating and cover up in a community outside of Boston. And, you know, because of my reporting on it, you know, a bunch of officers were accused of the use of excessive force and put on trial in Boston. And, you know, so, you know, this is something that not only do we have to deal with today, but, you know, we've had to deal with, you know, for decades, years, and actually centuries now. And let's be clear about this. The imperative right now is that this country is pulling itself apart. And it's literally burning itself down. And if you are an American, and if you consider yourself a patriotic American, you know, we have to deal with this now, or we will consume ourselves.
All right. So what role does Congress play in moving the country toward equality for all?
Well, there are a number of things that the Congress needs to do and needs to mandate into law. And so there is some kind of consistency, you know, from one end of the country to the other. You know, we do have to hold police officers accountable for getting and consider and to getting rid of qualified immunity. You know, we have to change the use of force standards. We have to ban chokeholds. We have to establish a national registry of misconduct by law enforcement officers. We have to mandate racial bias training. We have to have more expansive police training. And, you know, in Florida, you know, barbers go through more training than police officers. And we, you know, we have to require states to report use of force cases to the Justice Department. That's one thing. But, you know, as I made reference to before, there's an economic impact. There's an economic part of this. And that is, how do you deal with, issues in urban communities? You create jobs. You give incentives for businesses to start businesses in the inner city, because people who have a good job and are making a good wage are less likely to be involved with crime. And it is, you know, an antidote to the rampant gun violence that we see. And you know, that is something that in the big picture, in the long term, is I believe one of the answers to ending this incredible cycle of violence.
Well, we're talking with one of the three Democratic candidates for Congressional District 15. Alan Cohn is our guest. He'll appear on the ballot August 18th, and this is WMNF in Tampa. One more question about the police. Many of the protesters are concerned about the militarization of local police departments and sheriff's departments. Under the Pentagon's 1033 program, since 1997, at least $7 billion in surplus military equipment, everything from office supplies to armored vehicles to grenade launchers, have been given to local police and law enforcement agencies. What do you think of the program?
I think that it needs to be curtailed. I mean, it's one thing if you're talking about office supplies and equipment like that. But as you said, many of our local police departments are now almost have the same kind of armor that you would find in Iraq and Afghanistan in the major war. And what it does is it is almost an intimidator to local communities. Look, we want our police to be safe. They have dangerous jobs, and there is no doubt about that. But they also can't be seen in our communities as an intimidating army. The time has come to get rid of that program. We need to give police what they need to do their jobs, but that also means giving them the resources in, let's say, a domestic violence situation, dangerous situations that officers often get assigned to. They not only should be showing up, but they should be showing up with social workers who are trained to deal with situations like that, and to, you know, resolve situations before they escalate into situations that too often happens where people get hurt. I think that answers your question there. And you know, the other issue in terms of equipment is body cameras, which I've always found in my profession as a journalist, the sunshine on a issue is the best disinfectant. And if what is happening is captured on video and all parties know that they are being recorded, if the person who is dealing with the police knows that there is a video record of what's going on, and the police know that as well, there could be a better chance that things don't escalate into unfortunate ways. And how that is really relevant to this area is, for too many years, local police departments, or some local police departments, and even sheriff's offices have not used body cameras, and the result of that is, after the fact, sometimes what happened at a scene is unclear. And there is a disparity here in Florida because, I spent a whole hour of my broadcast on ABC talking about what Pasco County is doing in terms of police body cameras. But at the time, Hillsborough and Sarasota County did not use body cameras. This is also equipment, that could and should be used, that would have a profound impact in terms of what happens in our streets and our neighborhoods, and it would have a better profound impact than, an armored vehicle rolling down the street.
Do you support any further regulations on the sale of guns or ammunition in the country beyond what we already have?
Absolutely. I mean, I've said from the beginning of my campaign, military weapons belong in the hands of the military and no place else. High-capacity magazines. Do you know that mass shooting in Dayton last year? It took 32 seconds to kill 9 people. And what's really important about what I just said is that, again, I listened to your interview with Adam Hattersley yesterday. He could not say he was for banning assault weapons and large capacity magazines. And anybody who is listening to this broadcast right now has to know what kill your member of Congress is willing to die on. What issue is so important that you're willing to actually risk your position and not win the next election to take a stand? And I have had neighbors who have moved down to Parkland whose children were in the building when the shooting started. I know that my wife and I have held our breaths when we have gotten robocalls from our kids' school saying that there was a lockdown because of the report of a gun. We've received text messages from our daughter saying that she was sitting near the front door of her classroom and she was concerned she was sitting in the wrong seat if somebody busted in with a gun. How is a child getting an education in that way? And it's easy for me to say that I'm a gun sense candidate by Moms Demand Action and Fred Gutenberg, who lost his daughter Jamie at Parkland, has endorsed our campaign. I'm also a parent, so this is not a theoretical issue. There are other things that we need to do, like passing red flag laws and closing the Charleston loophole that allows you to get a gun after 3 days if a background check hasn't come back yet, or, close the boyfriend loophole that allows domestic abusers to get guns, and close gun show loopholes and devoting federal funding to gun violence research. But look, issue number one for me is the sheer numbers of assault weapons and large capacity magazines that are out there, and how today, too often, people showing up, and we've seen this in the news the last few days, using those weapons as a form of an intimidation. We have, as a society, have got to move past that.
Well, this is 88.5 FM WMNF in Tampa, and our guest is Alan Cohn, who's one of three Democrats running for his party's nomination for the 15th Congressional District seat, and that election is August 18th. Alan, how well has President Trump responded to the outbreak of COVID-19?
He hasn't. I mean, let's be clear. I mean, they were left an actual playbook on how to deal with a pandemic, and they didn't read it. A Columbia University study, showed that if we taken steps in terms of testing and closing travel earlier. We could have saved tens of thousands of lives. He has been a bad role model, continues to be so, and look at what the result is. When countries around the world have flattened the curve and are getting back to opening their economies and restoring their economies, we have more positive cases now than in March. And this is what leadership is all about. And unfortunately, it has become a political litmus test, and it should not be. It should not be controversial and, you know, to wear a mask in public. He holds rallies where they openly say social distancing is not required. And you have people, you know, saying it's a matter of their own personal freedom. Well, we all have personal freedom. We also all have a right to health, happiness, and the pursuit of happiness. And it's one thing if you put yourself at risk, which you should not do. It is another thing to put me at risk, or my family, or my elderly relatives at risk by coming in contact with them. And the president is supposed to be our leader. It's supposed to be a role model. And today we have just the opposite. And I think people know it. I think if you look at polling around Florida, people know it. People are tired of this. And it is, you know, every American's basic right to expect rational, sober leadership. I mean, we could disagree on a whole lot of different things. But this president has totally failed in terms of his most important responsibility, and that's the protecting the lives of the American people.
The Social Security Administration says that among elderly people, Social Security beneficiaries, 21% of married couples and about 45% of unmarried persons rely on Social Security for 90% or more of their income. As defined benefit pensions disappear around the country and more people working in the gig economy, Social Security is becoming more and more an important income source of last resort for many people. Some politicians have tried to privatize Social Security. Some have called for increasing Social Security benefits. What's your approach to Social Security?
Well, you know, Social Security is the most important safety net that we have. And as I speak right now, I want people to know that I will fight to protect Social Security. And we know the other side, as you just mentioned, has done its level best to privatize it, to marginalize it. And if we don't do something, it is not going to be there for our generations in the future. And there are a number of significant steps that we can take. Right now, there is a cap in terms of how much even the richest Americans pay into it. On a yearly basis, we have to remove that cap. If you are fortunate enough to make a good living, you are fortunate enough to be able to pay into the system so all Americans could have a safe and secure retirement. And ultimately, that saves money for our economy because when our seniors can't afford the basics, whether it's living at assisted living facilities or their prescription drugs, or just food, that winds up costing us in the economy more. So it's really important to note that we are not assured in terms of the safety and future health of Social Security with Ross Spano in the United States Congress. And this is one of the centers of our campaign.
Right now, if you work for a wage or a salary, as Warren Buffett has famously pointed out, you pay taxes at a higher rate than if you derive your income from investing. Do billionaires and profitable corporations pay their fair share of taxes? And if they don't, what would you do to make sure that they do?
You know, yeah, as you just said, wealthy individuals and large corporations don't pay their fair share. Hedge fund managers pay less in taxes than secretaries, as you you just mentioned. You know, what we need to do is, number one, roll back Trump's 2018 tax bill that actually raised taxes on the middle class and cut taxes on corporations and the wealthiest Americans. I don't believe that those tax cuts should be rolled back on middle-income Americans, but certainly the wealthy Americans. And we need to close offshore tax loopholes that allow corporations to use tax havens to evade, you know, paying their fair share taxes. We have to end deferrals so corporations pay offshore income in the year is earned instead of indefinitely, which allows them to avoid paying taxes. You know, we have to stop companies from setting up offshore subsidiaries for the purposes of funneling billions of dollars of profits through so they don't have to pay taxes on it. You know, I could go on and on. Preventing corporations from selling their patents and licenses at heavily discounted prices to offshore subsidiaries and transferring their licenses, you know, back to the U.S. Parent company so they can sell their products. So, you know, this is not about soaking the rich or any kind of Robin Hood. This is, basically allowing hardworking middle income and working families to have their fair share and equal opportunity to save for their future. And the current economic system is consuming this country. We cannot continue in a system where the wealthiest Americans get the biggest tax breaks and the corporations get the biggest tax breaks and middle-income Americans get the crumbs. I challenge anybody who's listening to this right now, if you're just a middle-income man or woman in our community, to tell us how the tax cuts benefited you. But I can tell you one thing, that a lot of corporations in our area and around the country, including Boeing, that reap millions in savings. And we don't do anything about this at our own peril.
Well, we're talking with Alan Cohn, who's running for Congress. He's one of three Democratic candidates in the race for Congressional District 15, which includes parts of Hillsborough and Polk and Lake counties. And this is WMNF in Tampa. Just going back to President Trump for a moment, we've seen how he's conducted himself for the last 3.5 years in office. Do you think President Trump is fit for office?
No. I mean, I think that's pretty much obvious, not only to Democrats, but to many Republicans and independents. And his own niece described him in her new book as a sociopath. We've had presidents on both sides of the aisle, many times that we agree with or disagree with, but I never questioned the patriotism of a United States president before. I think we have seen from the beginning that, even now, reports that the Russians were putting bounties on the heads of U.S. military personnel in Afghanistan, and not a word from our president. We are the last remaining superpower right now, but we seem to be handing over the keys to Vladimir Putin. And you hear John Bolton, who is an arch conservative, and no friend to Democrats, talk about the fact when he was in the White House as National Security Advisor, you couldn't even bring up Russia to the president. You have a president who does not like to be briefed by the intelligence community and basically pontificates wild conspiracy theories. The way he talks to women, the way he talks to political opponents, he has made being a bigot cool again in this country. And we need to do better than that. We deserve to do better than that. And, look, we have a number of good Republicans that are taking a stand. I'm dear friends with David Jolly, the former congressman from Pinellas County, who was a loyal Republican and left the party because he could not stand for what he sees. At this point, we have George Will, the conservative writer who was on ABC and the other networks for years, saying that he cannot support this man. So it is time to bring dignified and leadership back to the White House. And it's also time to make sure that the Congress, the Senate and the House, are belong in Democratic hands, so we could start rebuilding the damage that was done by the rollbacks, of regulations that has decimated the EPA, allow corporations to pollute with no enforcement mechanism. All these things have to be undone, because it's not just the personal behavior of this president that is atrocious. It's also what he has done in terms of government and to this country.
Among Congress's powers, they have the power to vote whether or not to authorize the president to go to war. The U.S. is involved militarily in many parts of the world. We still have troops in Afghanistan and Iraq. Have we been too quick over the last 30 years to get involved militarily in other countries, or are we using the military in the correct way?
I'll tell you what we have not done is we have not targeted where our involvement is from the get-go after 9/11. After 9/11, we were attacked, by Osama bin Laden, who had safe haven in Afghanistan. So what did we do? We outsourced that war, and we invaded Iraq. That was authorized by Congress. And if I were there at the time, I would not have voted for that because, the fight was in Afghanistan, and it took years to get bin Laden. And we do need congressional action to authorize the use of military forces. Now, that's not to say when an emergency comes up and when there is not time for a vote in Congress, that the president cannot respond to a military situation. But right now we have a president that is not even conferring on issues of great magnitude with what they call the team of eight, which is the Speaker of the House and the House Minority Leader, the Senate Majority and Minority Leader, and the chairs of the intelligence committees. They're not apprising them in real time about what's going on. That has always been at least a failsafe to that the Congress knows what's going on. But for this reason, with this president, he doesn't feel like he needs to do that. So yes, we need to alter and strengthen the War Powers Act, and we need to. It's a fallacy that the congressional action after 9/11 that authorized the use of force in Iraq can, over 20 years later, be used for any military action that comes up today.
Do you think China or Iran present a military threat to the U.S.?
They represent not only a military threat, but they represent a threat to national security. And not long ago, I actually devoted programming to look at what countries are doing in the cyber world to invade not only our corporations or our educational systems and our universities, but how they are using the cyber sphere to integrate themselves into our political debate. A lot of times when you get into fights and arguments on social media with people about politics, it's quite obvious that a lot of the most outrageous comments are by bots from whether it's Russia or China or wherever, and also Iran. And I actually went to a cybersecurity expert who showed me right on this on computer screen how the messaging was coming from extensions in these countries, and so we are already in many ways at war, and we are doing nothing about it, because what you heard during the Russian investigation is those in charge of the National Security agency saying that the real retaliation for the invasions that are happening in cyberspace need to come at the presidential level, and that is not done. And it's also important to note that Vladimir Putin aspires to regain Russia's status as a superpower. And right now, his efforts to do that are unchecked by this president, to the dismay of members of his own administration. So whether you're talking about Russia or you're talking about China, or you're talking about Iran, who is a malevolent actor in the Middle East. We have not done enough to keep those powers, even if they're regional powers, in check, and that's got to change.
Do you support the Green New Deal?
I support a lot of the elements of the Green New Deal, but I think that it is a broad policy statement, and some things can be done, and some things, I'll give you just one firm example. It calls for replacing every building in the United States, and that is something that cannot be done today. What I do support wholeheartedly is what came out of the House just within the last week or two, which is transitioning to a 100% clean energy economy by the year 2050, re-strengthening the EPA, as I said, as an independent, science-based and enforcement organization, putting a price on carbon and enacting a carbon tax, funding a jobs program to decarbonize every sector of our economy and subsidize and offer tax rebates to clean energy and subsidies to dirty energy like the petroleum industry. And the one incredible advantage that I have when it comes to this, and I'm so honored that I've been endorsed and supported by Terry Root, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, with Al Gore for their work on climate change. She lives right here in our area. She supports our campaign. She is working with our campaign to find real solutions to climate change. And she's helping us even talk to voters in the 15th Congressional District about why it's an imperative when you're dealing with our agricultural industry or our tourism industry. And let us not forget that right now as we speak, the 15th Congressional District is represented by Ross Fano, who is a climate change denier. He has made our community and our district a laughingstock. When so much of our local economy depends upon the agricultural industries, strawberry and citrus, and you have the water aquifers getting lower every day, we cannot afford to have a climate denier representing this congressional district in the United States Congress.
Well, Alan Cohn, we're out of time, but if people want to find out more about your campaign or get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Join us on Facebook at Cohn for Congress 2020. Our website is www.alancohn4forcongress.com. And join us on Twitter at Alan M. Cohn. And we're so excited about this race. We're so excited about the opportunity to, I want everybody to be aware that this congressional district, the I-4 corridor, is so essential to the presidential race, because this district is almost a bellwether for how far the will go. And I have a certain advantage because by anchoring the news and being an investigative reporter, people know who I am, and they know my work as an investigative reporter who has exposed public corruption in our area, and exposed, a guy masquerading as a decorated Marine Corps Master Gunnery Sergeant with the Navy Cross. I want to apply the skills and the tenacity that I used as an investigative reporter for the people of the 15th Congressional District in the United States Congress.
Alan Cohn, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF.
Thank you.
That was Alan Cohn, who's running for Congress in the 15th Congressional District. He's in a three-way race in the Democratic primary. The primary is August 18th, and that district includes portions of eastern Hillsborough County, Polk, and Lake Counties, the cities of Plant City, Lakeland, Bartow, and Brandon. Brandon, not really a city, but are in there. And we earlier this week heard from Adam Hattersley. I reached out to the other Democrat in the race and invited him on. We'll see if he accepts. And remember to go out and vote, no matter who your favorite candidate is. Well, we're going to open up the phone lines and take some phone calls about the issues that are in the news. And, of course, there's a big news story. The U.S. Supreme Court had a major decision today about President Trump's tax returns, and I'll read from the Associated Press in just a moment. But if you want to comment about what Alan Cohn said or about the congressional race, you can call us at 813-239-9663, and we'll put you on the air. Or you can send your email comment into dj@wmnf.org, dj@wmnf.org. Of course, this news is going to dominate today's news cycle. The U.S. Supreme Court issued a mixed verdict today on demands for President Donald Trump's financial records that will keep his tax returns, banking, and other documents out of the public eye for the time being. The court rejected broad arguments, though, by Trump's lawyers and the Justice Department that the president is immune from investigation while he holds office or that a prosecutor must show a greater need than normal to obtain the president's records. By a 7-2 vote, the justices upheld the Manhattan District Attorney's demand for Trump's tax returns, but they kept a hold on Trump's financial records that Congress has been seeking for more than a year. Trump, the only president in modern times who has refused to make his tax returns public, did not immediately regard the outcome as a victory, even though it is likely to prevent Trump's opponents in Congress from obtaining potentially embarrassing personal and business records ahead of Election Day. The documents have the potential to reveal details on everything from possible misdeeds to the true nature of the president's vaunted wealth, not to mention uncomfortable disclosures about how he's spent his money and how much he's given to charity. And the president lashed out on Twitter saying, "This is all a political prosecution. I won the Mueller witch hunt and others, and now I have to keep fighting in a politically corrupt New York. Not fair to this presidency or administration." The rejection of Trump's claims of presidential immunity marked the latest instance where Trump's broad assertion of executive power has been rejected. Trump's two high court appointees, Justices Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, joined the majority in both cases, along with Chief Justice John Roberts and the four liberal justices on the court. Roberts wrote both opinions, and Roberts wrote in part of the case, "Congressional subpoenas for information from the president, however, implicate speech concerns regarding the separation of powers or special concerns regarding the separation of powers. The courts below did not take adequate account of those concerns. The ruling returns the case to lower courts with no clear prospect for when it might ultimately be resolved." So we'll hear more about the U.S. Supreme Court decision on President Trump's financial records and his tax returns on the NPR News coming up in just about 7 minutes. And we'll take some phone calls and see what's on your mind. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. And let's go to John in Tampa, who's the first caller today. Hi, John. What's up?
Hi. Hi, Rob. Great work ethic. I can't believe this station is doing so many vital, vital stories. But my only comment today, and I'll hang up and get your opinion or your observations, and I may have missed it, so forgive me if you reported on it already, but there's a push by the Trump administration. Well, it's already done, actually. He's systematically replacing the management of Voice of America all over the world with Trump appointees, and I just wonder what the heck he's up to. I can imagine. Thanks, Rob.
Okay, John, thanks a lot. The Voice of America and all the other international broadcast facilities of the U.S., including Radio Free Europe and the television and radio broadcast to Cuba, Marti TV, I think it's called in the television case. Over the years, they used to be considered pretty propagandistic. And there's a rule, too, that they not be broadcast here in the U.S. because they're considered sort of like government propaganda. But they've become more professional over the years and less propagandistic. And I think that's what the president has trouble with. Although I think the broadcast services to Cuba are still pretty much dominated by people who hate the current government in Cuba. Other broadcast services that we broadcast to the Middle East, for instance, or to Europe, they've become much more professional. And occasionally they have criticism of the U.S. Contained in their broadcast. And I think that's what the president is mad at. Well, any legitimate news organization would try to be independent from the people that fund it and try to see things in a clear and fair way. And so if from time to time some of those broadcast outlets broadcast things that are critical of the U.S., let's say highlighting the high homeless rate or the high unemployment rate or the high poverty rate or the high number of people without health insurance in the U.S., which I think is part of the complaint that the president has, well, that's the job of journalism. But I don't think that the president likes independent journalism. I think he likes journalism that toes the line, and it's pretty clear from what he said about Fox News and One America News. Those are his favorites, but they toe the line. They, you know, if you criticize the president on either one of those channels, you're not likely to have a job for very long. Liz in Spring Hill writes this about the congressional candidates so far for District 15. She says, I guess the constituents in Congressional District 15 are tasked with a tough choice. Both of these Democrats are way off the mark. Now, this is Liz's words, or these are Liz's words. Both of these Democrats are way off the mark on health care, minimum wage, and Black Lives Matter. We still have work to do in the Florida Democratic Party, and we are doing just that in Hernando County. Stay tuned, writes Liz in Spring Hill. All right, and again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. You know, Neil Young has decided not to sue the president. Just a few days ago, when the president had one of his rallies, he played Neil Young's song at during the rally. It's not uncommon for the president to play songs by people who are ultra-liberal, like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Neil Young. And he plays those songs at his rally, and I think as a way to confuse his supporters about what he really stands for. He doesn't stand for the values that Neil Young has, or the Beatles, or the Rolling Stones. But Neil Young's not going to sue the president, but he did write a song about the president. He updated a song that came out in 2012 called Looking for a Leader. And here, we're going to go out with this. Here's Neil Young doing a song that he's updated about the current times.
The sun's going down on us, baby. Red, white, and blue before it turns to stone. Looking for somebody with the strength to take it on. Keep us safe together and make this country strong. Walking among our people, there's someone to lead us on. Lead a rainbow of colors in a broken world gone wrong.
You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Stay tuned for the Midpoint program.
Yeah, we had Barack Obama, and we somehow.